Hello, and welcome to Grand Dukes of the West, Episode 36, Bedford, Bourges, and Beyond. The king is dead. Long live the king. But now the big question is, which king? With Henry V of England and Charles VI of France dead within weeks of each other, the rival claims to succession that we covered in the last episode are now rival claims to the throne. And now, as we enter a new phase of the Hundred Years' War, we should briefly review the political geography of the conflict. Lancastrian France could be roughly divided into three categories. The first of these were the lands conquered by Henry V before the Treaty of Troyes, known as the Pays de Conquête. This was mostly the Duchy of Normandy, but also included several lands on its border, such as the Duchy of Alençon, the County of Perche, part of the County of Maine, the Vexin, and some territories in the Île-de-France. These lands were under the most direct English rule, and had formed the personal domain of Henry V after the Treaty of Troyes. Consequently, the second part were the treaty lands, the regions which recognized the Treaty of Troyes, but had not been outright conquered by the English. The treaty lands were generally the rest of France north of the Loire, apart from Orléans, Anjou, parts of Maine, and Brittany, or, in other words, the rest of the Île-de-France, Picardy, Champagne, and the lands of the Duke of Burgundy. The territories of Philip the Good were technically a part of the treaty lands, but they were certainly not treated the same due to the power and influence of the Duke. And, in many ways, Philip was an equal to the Lancastrian regime, rather than a vassal. At this point, the Duke of Burgundy controlled Burgundy, of course, but also the counties of Flanders and Artois, as well as a significant part of Picardy and other territories which had been gained by John the Fearless, such as Mâcon, Auxerre, and Tonnerre on the border of Burgundy. Also within the Burgundian sphere of influence were the counties of Saint-Pol, Nevers, and Rethel, which were ruled by cadet branches of the House of Burgundy. Finally, there was the Pale of Calais in the north and English Guienne in the south, or at least what remained of it. What had once been the sprawling Duchy of Aquitaine was, by 1422, a modest duchy which took up France's southern Atlantic coast. Guienne was still owned by the English, but was neither conquered territory nor treaty territory. While Guienne had been the focus of much of the first half of the Hundred Years' War, now, northern France was the priority of the Lancastrians. Campaigns both into and out of Guienne would still occur, but the duchy was far from the rest of Lancastrian France, and was surrounded by stridently Dauphinist territories. And speaking of Dauphinist territories, let's explore the half of France that considered the Dauphin to now be Charles VII. As a quick side note, I will continue to use the terms Dauphin and Dauphinist over the next few episodes, even though Charles now claimed to be king, as he was still often referred to as the Dauphin, even within his own party. His lands were, for the most part, France south of the Loire River, apart from Guienne. The core of Charles's territories was his personal appanage as Dauphin, the duchies of Berry and Touraine, and the county of Poitou. He set up his court in Bourges, the capital of Berry, and many important governmental functions were based there and in Poitiers, the capital of Poitou. Many in Lancastrian France, eager to point out that they held the capital, referred to the Dauphin's territories as the Kingdom of Bourges, painting it as provincial and apart from the true Kingdom of France. But the fact of the matter was that half of France was a part of the Kingdom of Bourges. In addition to Berry, Touraine, and Poitou, Charles also held the Dauphiné, which, while technically in the Holy Roman Empire, did border the other Dauphinist regions of Languedoc and the Lyonnais. To the south of Dauphiné, and also technically in the HRE, was Provence, which was owned by the House of Anjou. The Angevins also controlled Anjou and Maine, which were mostly north of the Loire and exposed to the English. Maine was partially occupied already, and Anjou was under threat, so the Angevins were fierce supporters of the Dauphin, as they stood to lose much to an English victory. The Dauphin had also married into the House of Anjou, and had been raised in part by his mother-in-law, Yolanda of Aragon. And as Charles had a turbulent relationship with his own mother, Yolanda ended up serving as the Dauphin's main maternal figure. The Kingdom of Bourges was also supported by most of the other princely houses of France, such as the House of Bourbon, whose lands were mostly southwest of Burgundy, the House of Orléans, whose lands were along the Loire and very exposed to the English, and the House of Alençon, whose lands had already been conquered by the English and made up a significant part of the Pays de Conquête. Now, I know that I just dropped a lot of place names, so if this all leaves you confused, I'd suggest checking out the website, granddukesofthewest.com, as I will be including a map with this episode that breaks down the division of France. The Kingdom of Bourges and Lancastrian France were in many ways separate kingdoms. Just like in earlier parts of the Civil War, both Lancastrian France and the Kingdom of Bourges had their own governments, but now the gulf between the two halves of France was growing deeper. With the Treaty of Troyes, the Civil War and Hundred Years' War had merged into something that was both foreign and domestic. Jonathan Sumption writes of an iron curtain descending between the two. Quote, "Movement between the two sectors was strictly forbidden and increasingly dangerous. In Paris, households were required to report arrivals from the rebel provinces. They were liable to be summarily thrown in prison. In the Dauphin's territories, residents found to have visited Paris were held as prisoners of war. Travelers were stopped on the roads and at city gates. Letters were intercepted, and the messengers punished. Priests, who could sometimes count on a measure of immunity, carried messages in their heads, often accompanied by some sort of token which would be recognized by the recipient. Parents and children, spouses and siblings, sweethearts and lovers, business colleagues from different obediences met surreptitiously and then petitioned for pardons. Legacies from parents and friends in one sector were confiscated by authorities in the other. It had been possible to hope in earlier crises of the Civil War that the storm would pass. But for many Parisians scattered through the French provinces, Burgundians who had fled before the June days of 1418, or Armagnacs who had fled afterwards, and for others who had been simply in the wrong place at the wrong time, it was becoming horribly clear that their exile was permanent." If you've been following along, you might have noticed that I left out the Duchy of Brittany, and that is because, at any given time, it could be considered a part of either Dauphinist or Lancastrian France. The Duchy of Brittany had always been among the more independent regions of the Kingdom of France, and one that had often had its own relationship with England. John V, the Duke of Brittany, had done his best to stay neutral in the Armagnac-Burgundian Civil War, and had had his own treaty of neutrality with England for years. But now, neutrality was much harder to maintain. John V refused to sign onto the Treaty of Troyes in 1420, but that didn't mean that he wanted to join the Dauphinists wholesale. John V and John the Fearless had been personal allies for much of their lives, despite their occasional opposition in France. And so, the Duke of Brittany, who had presided over numerous negotiations between the Dauphinists and the Burgundians, was incensed at the events on the Bridge of Montereau. He had been willing to help the Dauphinists launch an attack against the English in 1419, but after the murder of the Duke of Burgundy, he had revoked his aid and closed Brittany's ports to the Dauphin and his allies. So in early 1420, a conspiracy arose in the Dauphin's court. Many Bretons in Bourges, such as Tanguy du Châtel, resented John V and decided to throw their support to the Duke's rivals in the duchy, the House of Poitiers. Even after all these years, the scars of the War of Breton Succession still ran deep, and Olivier, Count of Poitiers, the grandson of both Charles of Blois and Olivier de Clisson, was determined to reassert his family's claims to the duchy. Olivia and his allies schemed to imprison John V and seize the duchy with the blessing of the Dauphin. While the first part of their plan went off without a hitch, most of Brittany was outraged at the imprisonment of their duke and refused to follow the House of Poitiers. The Duchess of Brittany, one of the Dauphin's sisters, took the lead in resisting the Poitiers. She ordered the confiscation of the County of Poitiers and summoned the military nobility of the duchy to carry out the order. A large Breton army was soon assembled and swept through Poitiers, causing Olivier to flee Brittany, taking his prisoner with him. Eventually, the now in-name-only Count of Poitiers agreed to release the Duke of Brittany in exchange for the restoration of his lands in the duchy. But while the Duke agreed to this, the Estates of Brittany refused to restore Penthièvre to the rebel count. John V returned to Brittany, while Olivia and his family left the duchy for their other lands. Through his support of the House of Penthièvre, the Dauphin made several enemies in Brittany and pushed the strategically important duchy further towards the Anglo-Burgundians. While the struggle for Brittany was ongoing, Henry V had been convinced to release Arthur de Richemont, a brother of John V, from his captivity. Richemont had been in England since his capture at the Battle of Agincourt, and Henry hoped that he would be able to turn Brittany towards the English. However, Richemont's release wasn't finalized until after John V returned to Brittany, and so Arthur would not end up serving as the duchy's regent, as the English initially planned. That being said, as part of the terms of Arthur de Richemont's release, he agreed to fight alongside the English. This was a valuable get for Henry, as Richemont was both a capable commander and was one of the most successful recruiters of his day. Arthur was always able to raise a regiment or two of Breton soldiers when the need arose, and now this was put to work on behalf of the English, who always seemed to be a bit short on manpower. But while Arthur de Richemont was a firm English partisan, at least for the time being, John V was more wishy-washy. Although he had aligned himself with the English following his return to Brittany, after his tempers cooled, he returned to his attempts at neutrality. The Duke of Brittany refused to ally with the English outright, but still remained aloof from the Dauphinists. As one side would gain or be set back, the Duke of Brittany would signal that he was ready to change or assert his allegiances. But he always tried to stay out of the war as much as possible. He cozied up with Charles after the Battle of Bougie, and his other brother, Richard, began leading Breton soldiers for the Dauphinists, but then returned to the English after the fall of Meaux. So while Brittany was technically on the English side in 1422, the duchy was more neutral than anything else. The Duke of Bedford, the regent of Lancastrian France in the name of Henry VI, saw an opportunity to consolidate his alliance with the Duke of Burgundy and bring Brittany further into the English fold simultaneously. And that opportunity was personified in Philip the Good's two single sisters, Margaret and Anne. We've had some dealings with Margaret already, as she had previously been married to Louis of Guienne. And, after 7 years as a widow, Margaret's new husband was to be Arthur de Richemont. Reportedly, the former Dauphine was unhappy at the choice, as she considered Richemont to be below her station as a mere count, and a landless one at that. But Philip urged his sister to think of the importance of the Breton alliance to the House of Burgundy, and sent one of his counselors, Renier Pot, to convince his sister of Richemont's merits. Pot argued that, despite his current lack of territories, Arthur de Richemont was, quote, a valiant knight, renowned for his loyalty, prudence, and prowess, well-loved, and likely to enjoy much influence and authority in France. These words were accurate and prescient, but maybe not in the way that Pot initially intended them to be. As, not to get too ahead of ourselves, but Richemont would eventually defect to the Dauphin, and would have much influence and authority in his court. The marriage between Margaret and Arthur would thus give the Duke of Burgundy a useful advocate in the Kingdom of Bourges over the coming years, but at the time, the match was meant to secure Richemont's allegiance to Lancastrian France rather than Bourges. Philip the Good was also eager to have his sister remarry, as the Duke of Burgundy was currently childless, and his wife, Michelle of France, had died a few months prior. At the moment, Margaret, as Philip's oldest sister, stood to inherit most of the Burgundian state, and if she had children, they might one day be the dukes of the mighty duchy. Anne, on the other hand, was to be wed to John of Lancaster, Duke of Bedford and Regent of France. The negotiations between Bedford and Philip for Anne's hand had been going on for a while now, and Anne didn't seem to show the same hesitancy for her match as her sister. Or, if she did, it wasn't recorded. As a part of the negotiations, Anne was named Philip's heir to the County of Artois and the Burgundian territories in Picardy if he were to die childless. As the terms of these marriages were being negotiated, Philip was also in talks with the Dauphin, once again held under the auspices of Philip's uncle, the Duke of Savoy. These talks were a real threat to the English, as Philip's support was a major basis of their power in France, and the Duke of Burgundy had many reasons to abandon the English after the death of Henry V. As the years went by, the initial shock, horror, and rage stemming from the assassination of John the Fearless began to fade, and other concerns began to take precedence. Of course, any peace between Philip and Charles would have to include the dismissal of the officers involved with the murder, and measures of official penance. But it did seem that Philip was at least open to the idea of accepting Charles as king, even if he didn't like it. In part, this is because Philip the Good was self-consciously a French prince, and even though Henry VI was a grandson of Charles VI, and the Lancastrian French administration was jumping through hoops to portray itself as French and hire French officers and functionaries, there was always some element of foreignness to it. But while this nascent patriotism was somewhere in Philip's head, material concerns were the larger issues. For one, war is expensive, and Philip the Good no longer had the access to the French treasury that his father and grandfather did, so large campaigns threatened to ruin the finances of the Burgundian state. The Duke of Burgundy did manage to get the Lancastrian regime to reimburse him for his campaigns most of the time, but they were still a drain on the Burgundian treasury. Moreover, as Philip officially recognized the English government in Paris to be the true royal government, the usual struggles between the crown and the great lords arose. There were other disagreements about Philip's commitment or lack thereof to the war effort, and some minor territorial squabbles, but the most annoying thing to the Duke was the tenacity of the Paris Parlement. The Parlement, the Royal High Court of France, had the right to act as a court of appeals for any judgments made in its jurisdiction, which included the Burgundian French lands. As the Duke of Burgundy sought to increase his power in his own territories, and the territories which had been given to him in the Treaty of Troyes, both de jure and de facto, those who resisted him could often appeal to the Paris Parlement. Richard Vaughan writes, quote, "With his allies the English in control of Paris, Philip may have hoped to find support in the Parlement there for his encroachments on royal jurisdiction, not to mention favorable treatment in the litigation in which he was constantly involved. But the Parlement resisted his attempts to usurp royal rights, especially in the territories ceded to him by the English. Moreover, its attitude insofar as ordinary litigation was concerned was uncompromising, and the ducal procureur and solicitor des causes there were kept as busy as ever. Far from benefiting from the English occupation of Paris, Philip seems to have had more trouble with the Parisian lawyers than either of his predecessors. While the English permitted Normandy to be withdrawn from these irritations, Burgundy and Flanders continued to suffer them." Additionally, two other issues began to drive a wedge between Philip and the English. The first of these was the marriage between John of Bedford's brother, Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, and Philip's cousin, Jacqueline of Bavaria. Our next two episodes will be focused on the pair, so all I'll say for now is that the match severely threatened Philip's interests in the Low Countries. The second of these was the burgeoning English cloth industry. For centuries, England had been a major wool producer, but only produced cloth for domestic consumption. However, towards the end of the 14th century, that was beginning to change. With the rise of English cloth, the economies of England and Flanders moved from complementary to competitive. Now the clothmakers of Ghent, Bruges, and Ypres had to compete with English clothiers for both English wool and for customers. The rise of English cloth also had a negative impact on the finances of the English crown, as the tax on wool exports was one of the chief sources of royal income, but cloth was not taxed in the same way. Therefore, as wool exports fell and cloth exports rose, the English crown lost important revenue to fund their war effort. In many ways, the tensions between England and Burgundy can be summed up in the person of Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester. It is reported that Gloucester and Philip never got on personally, even before they became political rivals, and Gloucester's moves after the death of Henry V only increased their enmity. Humphrey's marriage and ambitions in the Low Countries were the first issue, after all, and the Duke of Gloucester, seeing the Duke of Burgundy as a rival rather than a partner, made himself a champion of English cloth and stoked anti-Flemish sentiment in London. Gloucester was also in the midst of his own power struggle with his brother Bedford, and so saw no reason to temper his own ambitions, even if it threatened the Lancastrian project in France. And so, when the Duke of Bedford learned of Philip's talks with the Dauphin, he hastened to finish up the marriage arrangements to secure the Burgundian partnership before his ally could desert him. But while Philip the Good always kept some level of diplomatic contact with the Dauphin's court going, John of Lancaster didn't have too much to worry about, as these talks only ended up securing a regional truce for the southern flank of Burgundy and the Auxerrois and the County of Nevers in the west. Despite his growing disenchantment with the English, Philip considered himself bound by the Treaty of Troyes, as he had sworn not to make a peace deal with the Dauphin without English consent. The Duke of Burgundy was a wholehearted believer in the chivalric ideal of honor, and so he refused to break his oath by agreeing to a peace to which the English were not party, at least at the moment. And while the Duke of Burgundy made sure to kindle connections in the Dauphin's court, his interests were still well served by sticking with the English. However, the regional truce would prove to be quite beneficial to both the Burgundians and the Dauphinists, and marked Philip's slow but steady movement away from England and towards France. For the Dauphin, not having to guard his Burgundian flank meant that he could focus more of his manpower on the English, while for the Duke of Burgundy, the truce meant the end of raids coming from his borders, or from the handful of Dauphinist garrisons in his territories. Much to Bedford's annoyance, this truce would not lead to the reassignment of many Burgundian companies to other frontiers between Bourges and Lancastrian France, as Philip was doing his best to minimize his commitment to the English war effort by this point. But in early 1423, Philip ended his talks with the Dauphin and married his sisters to secure his alliances with England and Brittany, so the Duke of Bedford couldn't have been too annoyed with him. The marriages were proclaimed at Amiens in Picardy, and along with the marriages came the alliance. The Treaty of Amiens officially brought Brittany into the English fold, and John V finally swore to adhere to the Treaty of Troyes. However, the Duke of Brittany would prove to be just as fickle as an ally as he was as a neutral party. Even at Amiens, Philip the Good and John V entered into secret talks to discuss a possible reconciliation with the Dauphin. And after Amiens, John V's material contribution to the English cause remained at the bare minimum. But this conference was still a win for Bedford, and the marriage between him and Anne of Burgundy was reportedly a happy one, which kept the Burgundians on side for the rest of Anne's life. After the conference at Amiens broke up, Bedford returned to prosecuting his war against the Dauphin. His targets were the remaining Dauphinist strongholds in the north. But these campaigns spread out and diluted the English military might, so no significant fortresses changed hands in the first half of 1423. As the English were carrying on their minor sieges and campaigns, the Dauphin planned a major offensive to seize the initiative for once. The Earl of Buchan, the victor of Bougie, and Charles's Constable of France, led the Army of Scotland across the Loire in late June with the goal of relieving the Dauphinist garrisons resisting the English in Champagne, and then going on the offensive. However, Buchan got distracted by the town of Crevant, which was in the Auxerrois and technically covered by a truce at the moment. Buchan was convinced to besiege Crevant by a Dauphinist mercenary captain who had recently been booted from the town. And lured by tales of an easy victory, the constable decided to bite and began a siege of Crevant. The Duke of Burgundy was currently in Flanders, but his mother, Margaret of Bavaria, who was still Philip's representative in the two Burgundies, began preparations for the relief of the town, and sent word to her son and the Duke of Bedford, requesting military assistance. Margaret gathered an army of 1,000 to 2,000 Burgundian men-at-arms to be led by Jean de Toulonjon, the Marshal of Burgundy. The Burgundian army was soon reinforced by an English one of 500 men-at-arms and 2,000 longbowmen, led by the Earl of Salisbury, he of cafeteria steak fame. While Bedford's forces were spread thin at the moment, he really couldn't afford to lose the Burgundian alliance, and so broke off one of the many ongoing sieges in Champagne to send help. In fact, the very siege that Buchan was on his way to relieve before he got sidetracked at Creval. The Anglo-Burgundian force rendezvoused at the town of Auxerre in late July and left to face down the Dauphinist army at the end of the month. Meanwhile, the Earl of Buchan had been reinforced and now led an army around 7 or 8,000 strong. Both armies faced off on opposite sides of the Yonne River and waited for the other to attack. English archer fire and Burgundian artillery barrages opened the battle and immediately caused chaos in the Dauphinist ranks. As the Scots and French were distracted by the oncoming fire, one group of English men-at-arms advanced across a bridge over the Yonne, while another waded through a shallow portion of the river. Once these bridge heads on the Dauphinist side of the river were established, the rest of the Anglo-Burgundian army charged at the enemy. Seeing the tide turn in their favor, the Burgundian garrison in Creval left the city and attacked the Dauphinists in the rear. The attack from Creval broke the Dauphinist army, and before long, the battle had turned into a slaughter. Many Dauphinists did manage to get away, but around 2,500 were killed in the battle and pursuit, while hundreds more were taken prisoner, including the Earl of Buchan himself. The victory removed the threat of a Dauphinist offensive, but the threat of the garrisons still remained. Furthermore, the Earl of Buchan had broken the truce covering Philip's southern domains when he besieged Crevant, so now the Burgundian-held Bailiwick of Mâcon and the county of Charolais were being attacked. The Dauphinist forces in the region had taken advantage on the Burgundian focus on Crevant to take a number of forts in Mâcon, including the castle of La Boussière. Fresh off his victory, the Marshal of Burgundy went to take back these forts, and he was largely successful. Most of these garrisons surrendered upon the approach of the Anglo-Burgundian army. When the Marshal approached La Boussière, the commander of the Dauphinist garrison agreed to a conditional surrender, as had many of the other garrisons thus far. When the Marshal entered the castle to finalize the terms, he was seized and his forces were ambushed and massacred. While this was a setback for the Burgundians, and it would be another year until they retook La Boussière, it was not a disaster. Jean de Toulonjon's brother, Antoine, was named Marshal in his stead, and he continued the work of steadily pushing the Dauphinists out of Mâcon, and by the end of 1423, they only held two fortresses in the Bailiwick. The other big development for Burgundy in 1423 came at the end of the year, when a company of Burgundian soldiers and allied mercenaries managed to surprise and retake the town of La Charite in Nevers. The town, which had been taken by the Dauphinist commander Tanguy du Châtel the previous year, guarded an important crossing of the Loire, and now that it was back in Burgundian hands, it could serve as a base to launch raids and attacks into the Duchy of Berry rather than the County of Nevers. There were other victories in late 1423 and early 1424, such as Jacques d'Harcourt agreeing to a conditional surrender for Le Crétois, but in all, the English army was spread too thin to push a major advance after the victory at Creval. Still though, by the beginning of spring 1424, most of the Dauphinist garrisons in the north had finally been dealt with. Philip's role in these campaigns was quite limited, but John of Luxembourg did lead an army from Picardy and Artois in support of the English efforts. Once more, as his garrisons in the north faltered, the Dauphin was planning a major offensive. While the Army of Scotland had been battered at the Battle of Creval, support for the Dauphin in the Kingdom of Scotland was still strong, and Scottish soldiers trickled into Dauphinist France throughout the rest of the year. By the end of May 1424, he had assembled the largest army that the Kingdom of Bourges had seen in many years, or would see for many more. Between the new Scottish troops, soldiers from the Kingdom of Bourges itself, and mercenaries from Italy and Spain, Charles managed to gather an army of between 12 and 13,000 men. As the Duke of Bedford watched this army coalesce, he was faced with the possibility of desertion from his own allies. The tensions caused by Humphrey of Gloucester were only getting worse, and for the Duke of Burgundy, always one to hedge his bets, the idea of facing down this huge Dauphinist force was distasteful. He flat out refused to supply soldiers for the coming battle. The Dauphin's plan was to attack Normandy, the heart of the English occupation. Therefore, the Duke of Bedford called on the military nobility of the duchy to come to his aid. Still, though, his force was majority English. In the end, he gathered around 1,800 men-at-arms and around 8,000 archers to face the Dauphinist onslaught. The armies met at Verneuil, on the border of the Duchy of Normandy and the Île-de-France. The battle began with a cavalry charge. The Dauphinist cavalry attacked both wings simultaneously. The wings were mostly made of English archers who were ill-equipped to deal with such a charge, and the Dauphinists immediately gained the upper hand. The English line was about to break up, and many archers did break and flee at this point, but the rest regained their footing as the cavalry lost their momentum. The archers who had not fled the field regrouped and began a barrage of heavy arrow fire as the English men-at-arms began a slow but steady advance. The cavalry, now exposed to the arrows, retreated, straight into the advancing French and Scottish lines. Nevertheless, both the English and the Dauphinist forces continued their advance until they met in a brutal melee. But after an hour, it was the army of Bourges that began to retreat. As gaps began to form in the Dauphinist lines, the English cavalry unleashed a devastating charge of their own that routed the army and turned the piecemeal retreat into a mass retreat, and consequently, a mass slaughter. Over 7,000 Dauphinist soldiers died at Verneuil, including almost all of the army of Scotland. The Earl of Buchan, who had been ransomed after Crevant, died at Verneuil, as did many other important commanders in the Dauphin's army. While Verneuil is not a household name today, at the time it was hailed as a second Agincourt, and this one was even bloodier than the first. No quarter was given at the Battle of Verneuil. This battle was more consequential than Crevant, in part due to the exhaustion of the Kingdom of Bourges' military resources, and in part because Bedford kept the initiative after his victory. Almost all of the remaining Dauphinist garrisons in the north were now taken, and preparations were made for a major offensive into the Angevin county of Maine. Philip was in Burgundy when he learned of the Battle of Verneuil. His mother had died a few months earlier, and he was currently in his home duchy, taking stock of the situation. The death of Margaret of Bavaria was not only an intense personal blow, but it also meant that Philip lost a trusted agent who had capably ruled and looked after the defense of the two Burgundies for over a decade. The Duke of Burgundy decided to go on the offensive himself once he heard of the victory at Verneuil. There were still a handful of Dauphinist garrisons in his territories, and those needed to be dealt with. Philip, along with the new Marshal of Burgundy, Antoine de Toulonjon, and an English commander, finally exorcised the Dauphinists from the two Burgundies and their dependent territories. Not long after, Philip the Good was once more in talks with the Dauphin to re-establish the local truce which had been broken at Crevant. The Duchy of Burgundy, the counties of Charolais and Nevers, and the Bailiwick of Mâcon were once more protected from encroachment. While this truce was technically a temporary one, it would be renewed time and time again. We're going to leave the Hundred Years' War here for a bit, with the English victorious, the Dauphin reeling, and the two Burgundies at peace. Next time, we're going to move into the Empire, to catch up with the struggle between Jacqueline of Bavaria, her repudiated husband, John IV of Brabant, and her uncle, John the Pitiless. And we're finally going to see how Humphrey was alienating Philip the Good and causing such a headache for his brother, the Duke of Bedford. Thank you so much to my patrons, with an extra thanks to my newest patron, Eric, Comte de Couches, and to Christine, Duchesse de Nemours, Peter, Duke de Brancion, Elliot, Graf von Kravenstein, Anthony, Comte de Chateauneuf-en-Auxois, James, Graf von Temse, Preston, Comte de Saint-Fargeau, Mark, Comte de Mirceau, Diana, Graf von Biersel, Mehmet, Comte Santerre, Chris, Comte de Semur, David, Graf von Bornem, Rosa, Comte de Germol, Elliot, Comte de Bussy-le-Grand, Quentin, Graf von Blasfeld, Tyler, Comte de Chamaret, Ian, Graf von Arenberg, and to my Knights of the Duchy. If you want to join them, you can at patreon.com/valoisburgundy. If you want to support the podcast in other ways, you can do so by leaving a review on your podcast app of choice and telling your friends about the show. Both really help to grow the show and will earn you my everlasting appreciation. If you want to keep up with the show, you can follow me at Valois Burgundy on Twitter or Blue Sky, or find Grand Dukes of the West on Facebook. You can also email me at granddukesofthewest@gmail.com and check out the podcast website for maps, images, sources, and more at granddukesofthewest.com. Once again, thank you for listening.